Case number 12-1362 et al. Town of Barnstable, Massachusetts, Petitioner v. Federal Aviation Administration. Mr. Pilsk for petitioner, Mr. Lernitz for the respondent, and Mr. Morello for the intervener.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Eric Pilsk for the petitioners. Cape Wind Associates proposes to build an array of 130 wind energy turbines, each 440 feet tall, over 25 square mile area of Nantucket Sound. The turbines will be built in the navigable airspace, which extends below 500 feet over the open waters of the Sound. Unlike most or many open water areas, the airspace above the Sound is heavily used by low-altitude aircraft operations. Studies by the FAA and petitioners show that the turbines will cause a significant number of those aircraft to alter their course or altitude to
remain. All right. So in your brief, you start out by saying the agency made the same errors on remand as it initially made, and that it ignored our remand order.
Yes, Your Honor.
Slight overstatements.
But no, Your Honor, I don't think so at all. I mean, to start with, they expressly said, wrote the word only into Section 6-3-8C1 that the court found was an impermissible interpretation.
But they, in their decision, said, even though we have this interpretation, all right, we have gathered additional data specifically to respond to the court's concerns.
But the, yes, and they presented the data in the MITRE report, but they did nothing with it. And that was the central, I think, the point of the remand order was to not skip over the analysis, but to do the analysis and assess the risks. And that's what they didn't do.
So when you said, or when you say, their reference to seeking this additional information yet coming to the same conclusion, that's inadequate.
Yes, although it isn't that simple. In other words, our complaint isn't that they came to the same conclusion. That might be a separate issue. Point was how they got there. They didn't analyze the information that they themselves gathered. They didn't assess the risks that the turbines would pose to those aircraft and come to a reasoned conclusion that based on those assessments, there's no hazard determination.
Well, they have a paragraph that talks about the effect on VFR operations. And I understand your point if it is that the final decision didn't reference specifically some of the numbers that were mentioned in this supplemental MITRE report. But I just need to be focused on the defect in the analysis it did give.
Well,
I mean, it didn't write 20 pages on it.
No, but I think the point is, and I'm looking at, this is page 9 and 10 in the deferred appendix.
Right.
The FAA found it appropriate to study VFR operations in the vicinity of the proposed wind farm.
9 and 10 of the
appendix.
Decision or the JA?
You know, actually, Your Honor, I think it's both, but let me...
Well, I just need to know because that's the...
It's DA is what I'm looking at.
That's the response to comments page.
Well, earlier, Your Honor, let's go back to page 59 of the deferred appendix.
59? All right.
You know, well, this is the basis for their decision, that none of the turbines exceed any 14 CFR Part 77 Subpart C obstruction standard,
mm-hmm.
nor would they require changing the instrument flight procedure. None of the turbines would have an adverse effect on the use of the air navigation facilities or navigable airspace, and therefore no further analysis was needed. The point is that they cut the process short at that point and reached their determination that there was no need to study any adverse effects.
Okay, but that's dated, if I'm looking at what you're looking at, February 10th, 2012. That's in the public notice.
That was, you're right, Your Honor, I apologize. That was the initial public notice at the outset of the whole process.
All right, but let's be clear here.
Yes.
That was the public notice asking for comments, all right, telling the public what the agency was proposing to conclude. Then on August 15th, they come out with this final determination that you're challenging. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. So do you want to take me where you want to on this?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm looking, and I apologize if I'm jumping back and forth between the appendix and our joint addendum, but this is page 6 of 12 of the decision, which I have as page 6 in my addendum.
Okay.
And at the bottom it says, MIDA report, VFR traffic analysis.
Mm-hmm.
As stated previously, in studying the VFR effect for the airspace over the proposed wind turbines,
mm-hmm.
FAA policy provides that the proposed structure must exceed 500 feet AGL and be within 2 statute miles of a VFR route.
Okay, so then on page 7, they talk about the data analysis concludes and that there were many days, et cetera. I agree, it's not 20 pages, but tell me what specifically is missing.
There's two things. I want to go back to the page I was looking at because they conclude by saying that no VFR, based on those facts, no VFR analysis is required in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And then nonetheless, to address the concerns raised by the town court in town of Barnstable, the FAA requested MITRE to conduct the study. The point is that they've made their decision that there's no analysis needed, and then they present the results of the study as sort of a, well, here it is, and then they never use it because they say that the rest of those paragraphs.
What's page 7 doing?
It merely gives you a count, Your Honor. It doesn't provide any analysis of how those aircraft would interact with the turbines. It doesn't assess the risks. And that was what...
It says, therefore, I'm on page 7, in the first full paragraph. And then in the second full paragraph, it has some discussion.
But the therefore is simply based on, I don't know how they get to that conclusion, because mm-hmm. they simply count the numbers. And in fact, when you do the math, those numbers exceed the threshold of significance.
Mm-hmm.
And as we pointed out, this report undercounts operations in any event.
Mm-hmm.
And they simply say, based on these numbers, there's no effects. But how can you say that there's no effects based on numbers? The question is, how will the aircraft be able to see and avoid the turbines? Do they pose a danger to pilots flying in the airspace? That's the analysis that's missing.
And you reject their analysis about lighting and charting and mapping?
I do reject it, but more, I think, importantly, to your point, or to you, in your position, we have no basis to know whether that's true or not. There's no analysis.
But it's an agency's expert judgment that the visibility of the charting and the mapping are sufficient. I thought your burden was to persuade us that they overlooked something in their analysis that potentially could affect their judgment.
And what they overlooked, they stated those conclusions, but there's no information in the record to support them. It's just a bald assertion, which this court has found is not supported by substantial evidence. That kind of bald conclusion isn't supported by any analysis, any empirical information. There's no assessment of whether those lights would be visible in these particular weather conditions, whether the lights would be visible to pilots given the weather conditions and given the array of turbines that are being built, whether there would be time to see them and time to avoid them. The same kinds of issues that the court raised in Barnstable 1 haven't been addressed in any analytic or empirical way on remand, and that's the fundamental point.
Well, I understood that in Barnstable 1, what the court was concerned about was that the agency only looked at this one subsection of its handbook, and there were other provisions of the handbook that were relevant to the issues raised by your petition.
That's okay. One of the points on remand is that the FAA continued to only look at that one section, again repeating the same error that made before, and again refused to look at the other sections. For example, section 6-3-8B2,
mm-hmm.
which the court specifically referenced in Barnstable 1, which isn't discussed at all in this decision.
So tell me what you view as the difference between B2 and C2?
There isn't much difference in terms of substance, the language I place in different places. The point with B2 is that one is more specific than the other, I think. B2 says, in essence, if given, when you look at weather minimums, when you look at operations close to low weather minimums, and with particular reference back to B1, to operations over open water areas where the navigable airspace extends below 500 feet, you should be concerned about the particular dangers or risks posed by these structures. And in particular, if you find that these structures would actually exclude operations from a piece of airspace, it would have an adverse effect and would support a finding of hazard. You don't find that anywhere in the decision.
Well, isn't that because they've concluded that analysis isn't required? So at page 3 of their decision, they say, based on the foregoing, because there is no physical or electromagnetic radiation effect, under paragraph 633, there's no need to analyze whether the proposed wind turbines would have an adverse effect because they would not exceed the obstruction standards and do not have the physical or electromagnetic radiation effect. So the difference between this and Barnstable 1 is their finding of no electromagnetic effect. That's what they say, correct?
That's right.
Why they say this discussion about the VFR, they put it in for your benefit, maybe for our benefit, but they don't believe in the end it's decisive, correct?
That's their position.
Right. So now if I could follow you through on what I understand to be at least this court's previous view about how the handbook worked, you can tell me whether we were right or wrong, and then how this affects the FAA. In Barnstable 1, we begin by looking at Section 7-1-3E, which is the rule about determining whether or not to give a no-hazard determination, correct?
Okay, yes.
All right, that's what we say. It's at page 34. According to the handbook, the FAA can find a hazard if the proposed structure would have a substantial adverse effect. Right? That's what E of 7-1-3 says, right?
Yes.
Okay. Then the court says, our court says, how do we know whether it has a substantial adverse effect? That is defined in 635, right? So I go to 635. 635 says a proposed structure would have a substantial adverse effect if it causes electromagnetic interference, or, which in this case they found is not so. I appreciate you're going to have a substantial evidence argument about that, but I want to put that to the side.
Yes, right.
Okay. Or if there is a combination of, so it has to be both. Adverse effect is described in 633 and a significant volume of aeronautical operations as defined in 634. So then you have to go and look at 633 to begin with, right? Their interpretation of 633 is, and I'm now reading from...
I'm with you.
All right. I'm going to read from the new version of 633. Would you prefer I read from the old or the new?
You read from the new.
All right. The new says, if a structure first exceeds the obstruction standards, which it doesn't, correct, and or is found to have a physical or electromagnetic radiation effect, which it doesn't according to them, right, it has an effect, adverse effect, if it would, and then has a list of things, one of which is B, require a VFR operation to change.
Yes.
If I understand the FAA correctly, they don't need to go to B because there was neither an electromagnetic effect nor an accession of the obstruction standards. That's the end of the game. And the provisions that you're citing are all about requiring a VFR operation to change, and they're not relevant because they don't meet the threshold requirement of 633. Do I at least have, in your view, the government's analysis correct?
I think that correctly states their argument.
All right, now tell me, now put aside your substantial evidence argument. What's wrong with that argument?
There's two things. One, I think that it's not the correct reading of the handbook, and secondly, that position, even if it correctly reviews the handbook, is not a permissible reading of the statute.
Fair enough. All right, let's begin with the first.
Yes.
What's wrong with the reading of the handbook?
When you do look at 6388, you're talking...
No, look at 6388. First, is it a correct reading of 633? It seems like a correct reading of 633, doesn't it?
As far as 633 goes, Your Honor, that's correct. That's how they've drafted it to narrow it that way, and that's...
All right. So then why do we ever get to 638? Because 633 says you don't get to A through F unless you get to the thresholds. And B of A through F is the effect on VFR operations. And when we get to 638, this is about evaluating the effect on VFR operations. So we don't get to it because 633 says don't go to it.
But as they've emphasized, as the court acknowledged in the first decision, that these are guidelines. And 6-3-8 sets forth guidelines for how do you evaluate effects on VFR operations. And note specifically in B and B1.
No, I get it, but how do you get past the part in 633 says we don't look at that question?
Because B1B acknowledges that the navigable airspace extends below the 500-foot obstruction threshold.
B1B of?
6-3-8.
Right, I want to know why we ever get to 6-3-8.
Because it's a special case and an exception, because the navigable airspace extends below the obstruction standard. This section would have no application or meaning if you read 6-3-3 literally and limited in all cases.
Well, it would apply, and it would have applied, as we said in Barnstable 1, where there was no finding that there would be no electromagnetic effect. So it would definitely have applied then. You would have had an obstruction, but you would not have had an obstruction, but you would have had a VFR operation effect.
But maybe this is bleeding into the statutory argument.
Yes, but leave that aside.
But my point here is, why would you study VFR impacts when your triggering concern is radar or even obstruction standards? Why would you go ahead and study VFR impacts below 500 feet and under B2, have basis to find a hazard determination, but not even look at the question, not even study the question, if you don't have either the obstruction or the radar standard, but you're still left with the facts that would support a hazard determination?
Well, it's a hazard determination only according to them.
But
I can't tell. Are you arguing that their handbook is itself crazy, or are you arguing that they're misinterpreting their handbook? Which of the two is it?
Can I say both?
Well, you didn't say the crazy part in your brief.
You said it, Your Honor. I'm only agreeing with
you. You didn't say it was arbitrary and capricious in your brief. What you said was that they were misreading their own handbook.
We said it was misreading their own handbook and that it's an impermissible construction of the statute under
Chevron. That's another question, which we'll get to.
I appreciate that.
All right.
But I do think it's, regardless of the adjective used,
yes,
I think that it's an impermissible reading of
their
own handbook.
So your question is, why study VFR below 500 feet if what?
I'm sorry?
You started to say, why would you study VFR below 500 feet if?
If you were on the front end screening out all structures that don't exceed the 500-foot obstruction threshold. So now you're
and that don't have electromagnetic effect. Both,
right. But under their construction, you would say, well, let's say we have radar interference. Okay?
Because yeah. We do have radar interference, yes.
So now we have a radar interference issue. So we're going to now look at the effect on VFR operations,
right.
And we're going to look at the effect not from radar, but just in general of the structures below 500 feet,
right?
And
because they're worried that radar is not going to be able to guide the pilots away from those obstructions.
No, that's my disjoint here. Is when 6-3-8 isn't dealing with radar interference; it's dealing with the interference of the structures on VFR operations directly.
Yeah, I'll ask them what their reason is, but I assume it's because they can't get advice about the radar because the radar isn't working.
This section is dealing only with the as I read it, the impact of the structures on VFR operations.
It is, but they're saying that you only get to that if there's a radar problem.
And my point is that
your question is why?
Why would you find a hazard determination based on interference, how the structures would interfere directly with the VFR operations below 500 feet, when your triggering concern is radar, which doesn't have anything to do with that issue.
All right.
So let me ask you, are you arguing then as to the handbook that the agency's interpretation is contrary to the plain language in the handbook? If you start with 631, here's the policy, we're looking at safety. You look at 632, we're looking at scope. And then even when you get over to 638, it says these guidelines are for the use in determining the effect of structures. And then it goes on and lists them.
That's correct.
All right.
Which plain language are you referring to? I thought you
agreed. Well, I refer them to.
Which plain language?
Well,
their 633 says and you agree that it was a reasonable reading of it, you have to meet the threshold first. So which plain language says you, that they can't cut off 638 unless you get 633?
As Judge Rogers said, I think when you step back and you look at the policy statements in 6-3-1, that the purpose...
So it's not plain language. This is general purpose.
Well, it's their plain language of what the purpose is to protect safety and protect the use of the navigable airspace.
In other words, there are two... The agency interprets 633 as these two triggers. If you don't meet the two triggers, you don't get any more analysis. And I thought your argument might be that's not the way 638 reads on its face, regardless of whether it's consistent with the statute or not.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is our argument.
That's what I'm not understanding. The 638 begins, these guidelines are for use in determining the effect of structures upon VFR aeronautical operations, right? And that seems to be the question which is asked by 6-3-3B.
And
isn't it?
It is. And my point, and it's the phrase that you left out.
Unintentionally, I'm sure.
Absolutely. but it's key here because in the navigable airspace.
Yes.
And the fundamental problem with their analysis here is that these turbines are being built in the navigable airspace, which extends below the 500-foot obstruction threshold. They will have the kinds of effects that they would deem to be adverse and indeed substantial adverse effects under the rest of 6-3-3 if it applied under their reading.
But is that not the purpose of 6-3-3B to assess those things?
It is, and my point is that when you look at the factors that they identify under 6-3-H for how to evaluate the effect of structures on the use of the navigable airspace, there's an exception to the broad rule of 6-3 of how you deal with a special case of operations over open water where the obstruction threshold doesn't define the limits of the navigable airspace.
All right, let me ask you, assume you can get over the threshold that we defer to the agency on its interpretation of its regulations, its interpretation of its guidelines. Why, in this particular case, isn't the record sufficient to say that, and you don't need to repeat what we discussed earlier, but that because of Barnstable 1, the agency went beyond what it determined its regulations and its handbook required to meet the court's concerns, and such things as this MITRE study talks about, and then they ask for comments with regard to airplanes that the FAA doesn't know anything about. And the agency, I thought, responded in terms of saying that because of the planes that are involved, they're going to fly 500 feet above. They can make these adjustments just as they do now. In other words, I know you disagree with the conclusion, but I'm just asking, why haven't they addressed these things that are of concern to you?
Because there's no analysis, there's no evidence that underlies those are just assertions. For example, the response to comments.
But they're agency insertions based on all these studies they refer to.
But that's my point. There are no all these studies. All the studies they
cite. There are all these studies, counsel, and you know that too. They say it in their...
When you look at the studies, as we pointed out in our brief, most of them deal with radar. Most of them are simple reports of altitude, height, and location of the structures. There's no actual analysis that says, under the weather conditions that we have in the Sound, given the nature of the fleet, the pilots that we have, the courses they're flying, the altitude they're flying, these are the risks that these turbines pose.
But in its response to comments, it does address some of these issues.
And the problem there, and again, it comes with the positioning of their prior conclusion that there could possibly be no adverse effect and no reason to study in response to comments. There's, as the court pointed out in the first case, and as we point out in our brief, there's many comments from pilots, airline operators, airport operators of the nature of the effects. There are comments on the other side of the question, too. The FAA simply said, you say this, they say this. without reconciling the two and without taking into account in their conclusion why one position is wrong and one position is right.
Well, they say, I'm on page 7, in their first summary of comments, and then on page 8, the agency gives its response.
Yes, but they simply agree, but the question still comes down to whether those adjustments will be, not just will they be minor and brief, but can they be executed, given the real-world conditions that are out there? And there's no basis for them to conclude that. Does it happen elsewhere?
I'm saying that in their summary of comments, they reference positive and negative comments, and then they say, they agree with the positive comments, if I can put it
well,
that way.
Well, but my point is that, yes, that here are the negative comments. It's the comment that's raised, and our response agrees with the negative comments are in the comment posed, and we agree with the positive comments positive to the project, but they don't explain why one is wrong and one is right. And there's no analysis to support the way that they conclude.
But they say here in this response, again, it's not 20 pages, but it says, the FAA agrees that the adjustments may be minor and brief, and that these adjustments are made today, and it references section 91.119, minimum safe altitudes. That's its standard.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's bound by this standard, and,
I think that's
the end of their discussion.
It is, and the point is, these adjustments aren't made today because there aren't 400-foot turbines in the middle of the airspace. People make adjustments to stay clear of a ship or maybe another aircraft, but they're not making the kind of adjustments that would be required by this project, and that fundamentally is analysis that never takes place.
No, but they say their regulation specifically requires that aircraft may not be operated closer than 500 feet to any structure, which would include any marine traffic in Nantucket Sound.
That's true. But if you take that to the extreme, why would you ever do this analysis? That regulation absolutely applies everywhere. You have to remain 500 feet clear of structures. So you could build anything anywhere, and the aircraft would have to remain clear. Really, problem solved. Why even bother with the analysis? That's the problem here. They don't ask the question, if we build these structures here, will these planes be able to avoid the structures?
Okay.
I want to give you a chance to make the statutory argument, but before you do that, I just want to be sure if I get the handbook part right. So you think that I basically understand the FAA's view. You go from 713 to 635 to 633. You think their reading of 633 is reasonable, but you think 638 is independent. Is
correct.
That right?
Yes.
All right. Now, could you make your statutory argument?
Very briefly, the statute requires that if the FAA finds that a structure may be an obstruction, interfere with radar, or interfere with the use of navigable airspace, it must conduct a study of any adverse effect of those structures. The FAA is, in their construction under 633, they're saying we're only going to look at adverse effects if two of those conditions are met, if there's a radar interference issue or if there's an obstruction issue. They're not looking independently at whether there's some other kind of interference with the use of the navigable airspace.
Well, this is only, first of all, it is only about what kind of study has to be made, right? That's all. The statute doesn't define hazard.
That's correct.
And it says, if the Secretary decides that there may be an obstruction or an interference with equipment or the navigable airspace, then it shall conduct the study to decide the extent of any adverse impact, right?
Yes.
And there they have a regulation, they say, that defines adverse impact depending on the interrelationship of these different things, and where one and two don't exist, they think there's not a substantial, there may be an adverse impact, but there's not a substantial adverse impact.
Well, but that's again part of the disconnect. Under 633, under the ABC portion, we do have an adverse impact. These turbines would have an adverse impact, and the record does show that there's enough operation that would be affected that you would have a substantial adverse impact effect.
But it's up to, it says as the secretary, it's not, this is all left to the secretary's discretion.
We've already made that threshold determination that it may interfere, because that's the screening requirement under the earlier sections of Part 77 that exceeds the 200-foot threshold that triggers notice. We're already circularizing notice of this project because it may have those effects. So we're already past that point. Now we're asking the question of what are we studying? And the FAA is saying, well, we're only going to study two of those three effects. We're not going to study potential adverse effects of structures that may only interfere with the use of the navigable airspace, assuming no obstruction and no radar interference. So they've artificially narrowed. They've done two things wrong. They've read the or interfere with the use of the navigable airspace out of the statute. And secondly, they're saying...
Well, they haven't read it out. It depends on the circumstances. There may be circumstances where it would fit. It just doesn't fit in your case.
Well, no, right? Because they're saying 633, you only look at adverse effects if it's either radar interference or an obstruction.
Well, so there's three ors in the sentence, and it's very difficult with Boolean logic to figure out how the ors interrelate to each other. So in a situation where the first or applies, where there is an obstruction, then yes, they're going to look at the navigable airspace. And if there is an interference with the navigation, then they'll only look at it. But you have a... It's not unreasonable for them to have read the statute the way they're reading it as to when the first two are gone, or maybe even when the second two are gone, that the first one won't apply.
Well, I think the plain reading of the three ors is that there's a three separate clauses that all apply. So that it's either an obstruction or radar interference.
So they've studied it because, I mean, they can study it even if it's only may alter a structure, which... They did. That's the reason they studied it in the first place, right?
But then that's the point. Then the statute says you must study any adverse effects, and they don't study any adverse effects because they're not studying the adverse effects of these structures on the navigable airspace.
Well, when they start, they don't know. In fact, in this case, they did. In the beginning, they thought it was going to have an electromagnetic effect. So in the beginning, you don't know whether it's going to have these things. So you study these things, but not every factor is going to make a difference in the final hazard determination.
But my point, again, is that they cut that analysis off by never asking, how will this interfere with the use of the navigable airspace? Are there adverse effects on the use of the navigable airspace? That's the question they cut off and never asked.
But you want more than just a study, right? You need a conclusion. Your view is that the statute, which just talks about what kind of study to do, requires in the end that all those elements play in the hazard determination. Is that right?
Right. I have two points.
Wouldn't it be a more direct way to say that, which is?
Well, two things.
Definition of hazard.
Before they make their decision, they have to do the analysis to support the decision under their adverse effects analysis. They haven't done that. So, yes, I think these are a hazard, but they're not even in a position to say whether or not it would be because they haven't done the work. Number two, we don't have a problem with their definitions of adverse effects or substantial adverse effects or even hazard. This project triggers all those requirements in terms of the number of aircraft affected, the way that they'll be affected. So under the rest of their construction, we're entitled to a final determination up or down.
But you do have a problem with them concluding that if there's neither an electromagnetic effect nor a hazard nor an obstruction, that's the end. You do have a problem with that, right?
That
second statement is incorrect because that concedes your case.
I'm sorry. I certainly didn't mean that.
I'm not sure what I said.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. We understand.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll hear
from
the government.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Daniel Lenners for the Federal Aviation Administration. Let me start off by saying, Judge Garland, you were correct in FAA's interpretation of its handbook. And Judge Rogers, you were correct in that regardless of whether 638 is independent or dependent on Section 633, FAA analyzed the effects that these turbines would have on VFR flights under the conditions set forth in Section 638 and appropriately concluded that the turbines would not pose a hazard to flights using VFR because they could be easily circumnavigated and easily seen due to the bright lights and would be marked on maps and charts. That factual conclusion was supported by substantial record evidence, including the MITRE study, which showed that very few flights, something like 427 over 273 days, flew below 950 feet over the turbines. The vast, more than 50% of those were over the southeastern four most turbines, and so flights could simply go around them to the side, to the open water. They were supported by comments inserted into the record by local airmen who said that weather conditions over Nantucket Sound do not change that quickly, that if you're at one airport, the weather conditions will be the same over the project site as they are over that airport. And so FAA, taking into consideration these comments and where pilots flew as determined by the MITRE study, appropriately concluded that these turbines would not pose a safety risk. So regardless of whether 633 in fact triggers the, whether 638 is independent of 633, FAA appropriately
considered. What about the second sentence of 6382? And I'm going to leave aside the question of whether 638 is independent at all. But it says any structure that would interfere with a significant volume of low altitude flights by excluding or restricting in a specific area would have a substantial adverse effect. I assume since this is under weather, this is under a weather circumstance.
That's right, Your Honor.
So isn't there record evidence that it's at least one per day, and isn't one per day the test under the handbook of what's a significant volume?
One per day is the test under 634 of what constitutes a significant volume of aeronautical activity. However, FAA did not discuss 638B2 because, as Your Honor recognized when speaking to Petitioner's Counsel, that section simply doesn't apply here. Flights will not be excluded.
That's what I misunderstood. I thought you were saying that even if it did apply, I thought in response to the points Judge Rogers was making, that I thought you were saying that even if 638-2 was independent, it was FAA still analyzed it and it passed the analysis. Did I misunderstand?
No, Your Honor. FAA addressed 638C, which is the effect on en route operations, which is
yes, but what about 2? 638 B2. Because you started talking about weather a minute ago.
That section doesn't apply here because flights won't be actually excluded or restricted from the area. As FAA noted in its no-hazard determinations, pilots using VFR can easily circumnavigate the project. They aren't excluded from the area of Nantucket Sound when there are weather minimums. This section applies when weather minimums combined with a structure might prevent pilots from flying in an area altogether. And that's not the case here, because while pilots may have to go around the turbines, they can still fly in the area of Nantucket Sound. They can still fly between airports.
So this is not interfere with by changing the pattern. This is interfere with by restricting or excluding.
That's correct, Your Honor. Right.
And where is the finding? Is there a finding that they wouldn't have to do that?
The record doesn't, or the no hazard determination doesn't specifically reference 638B. It does say in response to comments that the proposed structures would be appropriately marked and lighted to make them conspicuous to airmen should circumnavigation be necessary. This is not unusual and does not create a safety risk. They're agreeing with the response that, or they're responding to a comment that said aircraft would have to circumnavigate, change altitude or route, especially during the frequent periods of marginal VFR weather.
So you're saying the implicit finding there meets consideration of B2?
Yes, Your Honor. The no-hazard determination makes clear that the next sentence, FAA acknowledges that some operations may have to circumnavigate around the wind farm, but they found that this doesn't create a safety risk. This comment is specifically referencing the considerations in 6.3b.
So the wind farm is not the specific area? Is that what you're saying?
FAA's interpretation of that part of the handbook is the area is the general area. Operations will not be excluded from flying over the wind turbines. They will not be restricted. They will be allowed. They will be able to fly in this area.
What about in bad weather?
In bad weather, FAA found that pilots using VFR can safely circumnavigate the turbines, that they will be able to see them because they will be marked, that they will know where they are because they'll be charted on maps. And these are the
kinds... So this depends on the word area being a broader area than just the wind farm, then, right?
Yes, Your Honor, which I think is a reasonable interpretation of what FAA's own internal guidance.
So what, now, if I can go back to the first question, what is the argument for why 638 is not relevant at all because it's not independent of 633?
As Your Honor recognized, 633 has a first sentence, which is a triggering condition, which is not met here, and then several factors that FAA is to look at. Those factors are then discussed in more depth in subsequent handbook sections. So, for example, one of the factors is the effect on VFR operations. That's handbook section 638. One of the considerations is the effect on IFR operations. That's handbook section 639. One of the considerations is effect on radar. That's handbook section 6310. One of the factors under 633 second sentence is the effect on local airports. That's handbook section, I believe it's 637. And so it's FAA's view that 633's first condition triggers this more fulsome look at these factors. And that this court's original decision, it found that FAA improperly skipped over 633 second factors to 638. Here, FAA found that 633 wasn't triggered at all, and thus further analysis wasn't necessary, but it did further consider the turbine's effect on VFR operations in light of this court's previous concerns in the previous Barnstable decision.
So in Barnstable 1, in the decision that was being reviewed by the court, there was no 633 trigger finding?
No, Your Honor. The 633 was triggered in Barnstable 1 by the effect on radar, on the ASR-8 radar.
And then now this change in January of 2012 resulted in a different finding.
Yes, Your Honor. And the original,
as to the triggers.
Yes, Your Honor. In the original Barnstable decision, mm-hmm. FAA found that 633 was triggered, and thus, because of the effect on the ASR-8 radar, and the way to ameliorate that effect was through the installation of a TDX 2000 processor.
Right, yeah.
So 633 was triggered. In January 2012, independent of this case, a TDX 2000 was installed at the ASR-8. FAA found that did ameliorate the effect on radar, and thus that 633's triggering condition was no longer met, and therefore that the further analysis was not necessary under the handbook.
All right, so let me ask you... So in response to you're saying this is a reasonable reading of the handbook.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the petitioner's argument is, these are my words, not their words, maybe so, but here, given the location of the turbines and how tall they are, there is this airspace, since we're over water, under the 500 feet. So these triggers, to the extent they exclude any examination, don't make sense in this factual setting.
So I understand petitioners today making several arguments, one of which is that FAA didn't comply with its handbook, a second of which is that the handbook is an arbitrary and capricious mm-hmm. expression of the statutory intent, which mm-hmm. I think is what Your Honor is asking. And the statute, as Judge Garland points out, simply sets forth conditions under which a study must be conducted,
right.
And then things that must be looked at.
Right.
It's undeniable that FAA engages in a study when there may be an interference with the navigable airspace. It has notice provisions that go far beyond the obstruction standards. And then it's undeniable that FAA conducts an aeronautical study that looks at the appropriate factors for every case in which it receives a notice. That's set forth in the handbook. That's
right.
A combination of 611 and 632. In certain circumstances, FAA will then do further analysis and perhaps determine that something constitutes a hazard to air navigation. That is what petitioners are saying is the arbitrary and capricious.
Right.
But the statute says nothing about a hazard determination. That's a creature of statute. That's something that FAA has set a certain line for when something will or will not constitute a hazard.
What's a creature of statute?
The hazard determination is a creature of regulation and the handbook.
Is the word hazard anywhere in the statute at all?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
In any of the statutes related to the FAA, sort of around this one?
I'm not that familiar with the other statutes.
Nothing charges. That's relevant to us.
Not that I'm aware of, and not that petitioners have pointed the court to. And so FAA undeniably conducted the necessary study. It appropriately and correctly applied its handbook to conclude that these turbines would not constitute a hazard to air navigation.
But
that ultimate conclusion is no way.
The statutory language, though, is a little bit broader than you suggest, isn't it? I mean, it talks about when notice is required to be given to the agency, and then it talks about these studies, starting off with, you know, under regulations prescribed by the secretary. But the whole point is to have this study address the extent of any adverse impact on the safe and efficient use of airspace.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if you look at Handbook Section 632,
right.
FAA explains that for every notice it receives, it conducts an aeronautical study that looks at these factors.
Right.
In certain instances, it will decide that based on how those factors interact, it will conclude that something constitutes a hazard to air navigation. But that conclusion and the circumstances under which FAA will reach that conclusion is nowhere compelled by the statute. The statute says nothing about hazard to air navigation. Again, that's a creature of regulation and of the handbook.
And it's a reasonable interpretation of Congress's concern about air safety.
That's correct, Your Honor. In all of these instances, FAA issues a determination in which it addresses the factors and discusses them as Congress.
So why do, if the agency knows from the start that it's not an obstruction, which they can easily know by the size, and that there's no electromagnetic interference, which is more straightforward also. The statute seems to say you still have to study the effect on navigable airspace. Why would it require a study if that wouldn't be relevant under those circumstances?
Your Honor, FAA does do a study.
Why? What's the point of doing the study if, in your view, it's irrelevant?
Your Honor, the triggering condition is whether it may constitute an obstruction or have an effect on radar or an interference. So FAA requires notice, and that notice causes it to do the study required by Congress. That initial study may conclude that it's not an obstruction, does not have the interference, and FAA will issue a determination of no hazard. In certain circumstances, that initial study is inconclusive, and FAA does a further study, and that's when it circularizes public notice, gets additional information, and does a more in-depth study, as it did here. It's an information-pushing statute, and in all cases, FAA considers these factors, issues a determination that discusses them, and applies its handbook provisions to decide whether that determination will ultimately be called a hazard determination or ultimately be called a no hazard determination.
So what does it mean when it says, on completing the study, the Secretary shall issue a report disclosing completely the extent of the adverse impact on the safe use of the navigable airspace? So in your view, the FAA's view, once there's no electromagnetic effect and once there's no obstruction, doesn't matter whether it has an impact on the use of the navigable airspace, right?
Under those circumstances, FAA has interpreted the word adverse impact in such a way that it will conclude that there is no adverse impact, even if there may be an effect. No adverse impact that would trigger a substantial adverse impact that would then lead to a hazard determination. It will nevertheless issue a study that discusses the effects that the proposed structure will have on everything, including the navigable airspace.
What about the question that opposing counsel raised, which was the argument that radar has nothing to do with the VFR operations in 638, so why wouldn't it be dependent on rather than, why would 638 be dependent on 63 determination rather than independent of it? What's your answer to that?
It's when something like radar might be affected that FAA is going to have additional concerns about its effects on VFR. If radar is not affected...
But why? Why? I tried to formulate why that was, and it would be more helpful if you could formulate why that is.
Because when you're going to have additional concerns about the number of flights and where they're flying when you may not be able to see them on radar. When you can see those flights on radar, you are not going to have the same concerns about where precisely pilots are flying, at what level, and in relation to structures. These pilots, if you'll remember, Your Honors, are not being instructed by air traffic control. They are responsible for their own plane. They are using their eyes to stay away from structures, to stay away from other planes. It's their sole responsibility for their safety. When air traffic wants to be able to see them because it is directing other planes, but it's when there may be an effect on FAA's ability to see those planes that it's going to have increased concern about where they are and where they're flying. If the court has no further questions.
Well, I do, actually. Just so I'm clear, if I were to own a little private plane, I have to pay to store it, but I don't have to file any flight plan?
I don't know the answer to that.
All right, never mind. Okay, so as I understand it, can we talk about the radar for a moment?
Yes, sure.
The petitioners say that one of the reasons that there isn't substantial evidence to support the agency's finding is the evidence about the problems at Travis Air Force Base in California with radar shadowing. And the agency doesn't respond to this comment at all.
Your Honor, petitioners point to an advisory circulated by the Department of Defense that says flights flying over these turbines have to be squawking in order for us to see. What that means is the planes have to be using their beacon transponders. My understanding is that the Department of Defense uses different thresholds for what it considers to be an acceptable probability of detection using primary or search-only radar. So the Department of Defense circular, which is just a standalone document, doesn't mean that you're not able to see the planes at all using primary radar. It means that the ability to see them on primary has fallen below the Department of Defense's thresholds, which is my understanding are higher than FAA's thresholds. FAA's 2009 impact study found that the probability of detection due to the turbines would not fall below the 80% threshold.
Which
that
study
FAA
is
applies.
That?
The 2009 impact study, Your Honor.
By whom?
Record entry, it's tab 18 of the Joint Appendix, Your Honor.
Okay, just let me get that. Tab 18.
Yes,
all
sure.
Right. And then did the agency at some point address the expert testimony questioning FAA's methodology?
Not directly in its no-hazard determination, Your Honor. The no-hazard determination relied on the 2009 study that I just referenced, as well as several subsequent studies that looked at the effectiveness of the TDX-2000 post-processor. There's also the 2010 Guidelines for Evaluating Wind Turbine Impacts to Radars, tab 50, which discusses the effect that turbines may have on radars. It focuses on turbines that are more than 6.5 nautical miles from radar as those that are going to have significant effects. These turbines are more than 9.5 nautical miles from the nearest radar. That 2010 guidelines also discusses things like the effectiveness of the TDX-2000, how it was used with an ASR-8 at Palm Springs, which has many more turbines, 2,200, which are much closer together, and how it was used effectively with an ASR-8 radar. The Palm Springs installation, again, many more turbines, much closer together, is discussed also in the 2009 impact study. FAA has a great deal of experience with the interaction between wind turbines and radar with the use of the TDX-2000. Based on that experience and based on its expert studies, it has concluded that these turbines will not have an effect on FAA's ability to conduct normal air traffic control operations in the area.
Okay. All right. Is there time left? Oh, I'm sorry. We have an interviewer. We're here.
Please the court, Christopher Moraro for intervener respondent, Cape Wind Associates. And with me at council table is my partner, Geraldine Edens. Before turning to the NEPA issues in the case, I wanted to briefly address three of FAA issues. First,
just keep in mind you only have 4 minutes and 38 seconds left, so if you're going to discuss the NEPA, which seems pretty important, you might want to slip right into that first.
Why don't I slip to that, Your Honor? There has been a massive NEPA process on this project. The lead agency, Department of Interior, has 9 years, 8,000 pages of environmental analysis.
So let me just cut to the chase here. In Barnstable 1, the court talked about how the Department of Interior is not going to move until the FAA makes a no-hazard determination, so that there is this direct reliance. And so the argument is, therefore, the nature of the no-hazard determination is, to the extent another agency is relying on it, a final agency action.
Your Honor, the touchstone of whether NEPA applies here is, does the agency have discretion to consider environmental considerations in its decision? And it does not. And let me give you a very short illustration. If there were a proposed electrical generating station which had a stack 250 feet, and they gave notice to the FAA under the alteration or construction section of the regulations, it would be reversible error if the agency would issue a determination of hazard based on the fact that there was unacceptable air pollution. And why is that? That is because the agency does not have discretion here to consider any environmental impacts in its determination of hazard and no hazard.
And I will find that clearly set forth where?
I think, Your Honor, you wrote the opinion in Coalition of Rails to Trails, the Surface Transportation Board.
Right.
So not only do they not have, is NEPA not apply here, but petitioners don't.
That's the standard.
That's correct.
I understand. But we know FAA has no such discretion because it's not in this section of the statute. That's all I'm getting at.
FAA has no discretion.
Because the statute doesn't authorize them?
Because its regulations and handbook and statute do not authorize it taking into consideration environmental issues in issuing determinations of hazard and no hazard.
Can I ask all the issues that environmental issues that are raised by airplanes flying over this area, noise, view, plus all the considerations that have to do with the mitigation requirements that were put in? construction of new radar or whatever, are those all considered by the Interior Department?
The Interior Department did its own environmental study.
But would they
study?
Be required to consider? Imagine that the FAA said, in order to mitigate this, you have to build a huge control tower at one of these airports. And people around the airport say that has an environmental impact for whatever reason. Would the Interior Department, you're saying the FAA could not consider that, right?
Yes.
Does the Interior Department have to consider that?
Yes, because they have to consider safety.
Well, I wrote another opinion.
No, not safety. No, I'm not asking that. I'm not asking safety. Yeah. Would they have to consider the environmental impact? The FAA says, as a matter of safety, you have to build a very large tower in the middle of Barnstable.
Right.
And that tower has to be made of a toxic chemical in order for it to work. Does the Interior Department have to evaluate the under NEPA the environmental effect of that?
Yes.
And why do you say that, or how do you know that?
Because there is 8,000 pages of an environmental analysis, and some of the environmental analysis done by the MANGI Environmental Group report does evaluate that and was considered by the Department of Interior.
All right. The fact that it is considered by another agency is not necessarily dispositive. I wrote another opinion citing provisions that authorize and require the FAA to consider such things as noise. All right. So it's not a question of whether FAA has no authority to consider matters that may relate to noise, no authority to consider matters that may relate to environmental considerations. I don't think that's just accurate as a matter of law, is it? And the agency itself isn't making that argument. It's simply saying that its no hazard determination is not a major federal action, that FAA has no authority to stop this project. So that its no hazard determination is not a legally enforceable decision. Isn't that the
argument? That is another reason why NEPA doesn't apply here. And the case that petitioners cite, the only case they cite, New York, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is quite distinguishable. Mm-hmm. In that case, the agency, the NRC, has control soup to nuts of the entire licensing process. Mm-hmm. And they issued a policy guiding future determinations, licensing determinations. Here, that's not the case. FAA, even if it wanted to, could not authorize or prohibit the construction of the wind turbines. I would like
it's a good
to,
thing we needed time to do NEPA first because we're now over time. So unless you have something that the FAA did not mention in their argument, I think we should be finished. Do you have any? They did not mention.
Yes, okay. 2 points. Okay. I'd like to call the court's attention to 7-3-1 of the handbook, which is the hazard determination. That section allows a hazard determination only on three conditions which are in the conjunctive, and I call the court's attention to the last condition, which is that the affected aeronautical operations cannot be adjusted to accommodate the structure. FAA found that they could be accommodated. They found specifically at Joint Appendix 8 that flight adjustments would be brief and minor, and that aircraft make these adjustments today, and there is substantial evidence in the record to support that at tab 15 and tab 42. The final thing I want to mention, Your Honors, is that these are 130 separate determinations that are under review, and petitioners' complaints, okay, at most affect the tail 4 in the southeast corner of the facility, proposed polygon.
Further questions? Thank you.
You're welcome.
I assume no time left. We'll give you time to respond to both these arguments.
I will be brief. I think a point that Mr. Leonard's made underscores the fundamental problem here. When he described that there's no basis, the aircraft already make these changes, and they can make the change in course and altitude to avoid it, and you're not going to exclude them from the airspace. The fact is the aircraft can fly where the turbines are proposed to be located now, and when you put the turbines there, they won't be able to fly there. They'll either run into the turbines or have to clear 500 feet to remain clear of them. This is exactly the kind of situation that 6-3-8-2 is talking about, and exactly the kind of situation that affects the use of the navigable airspace. And it sort of puts the cart sometime, way before the horse to say, well, there's no problem here because aircraft can avoid the area once the turbines are built, or that we're concerned about radar impacts, when the question is, are these turbines going to affect the operations of aircraft now? I think that underscores sort of the cart before the horse approach to their entire analysis by not really looking at how the construction of the turbines is going to change things and whether that can be appropriately accommodated. Secondly, let me just briefly talk about the NEPA.
Yeah, could I just ask about the NEPA? So is there any element of the FAA's decision, the environmental impact of its decision, that won't be considered by the Interior Department? Or that wasn't considered?
It depends on what the FAA's decision turns out to be.
Well, imagine it's the one that they just turned out to be.
Well, yeah, the decision that came out now has not been assessed.
I know, but now won't it have to be assessed?
Presumably, eventually. But the question under NEPA is, and NEPA can accommodate that by having agencies cooperate as participating or cooperating agencies in the same study. We're not saying FAA has to do it. It's an entire new separate study.
Well, in the public citizen case, Supreme Court's opinion, Department of Transportation, it says, inherent in NEPA and its implementing regulations is a rule of reason, which ensures that agencies determine whether and to what extent to prepare an EIAs based on the usefulness of any new potential information to the decision-making process. When the preparation of an EIS would not serve no purpose in light of NEPA's regulatory scheme as a whole, no rule of reason worthy of it would require an agency to prepare an EIS. As long as the Interior Department looks at all of the effects of placing Cape Wind where it's going to place it, including all the effects relating to the changes in the paths of the airplanes, the mitigation of the radars, why does it matter to you whether it's the Interior Department or the FAA that conducts that study, or why should both have to conduct the study?
Well, because FAA's decisions are independent of Interior's. FAA's decisions are imposing affirmative obligations as a condition of getting the no-hazard determination on Cape Wind, which in turn imposes obligations also on Department of Interior. Department of Interior doesn't know what to study until FAA has made its decision.
Right, but now it's made its decision, they both know at exactly the same time. The FAA has made its decision, and the Interior Department know its decision.
And actually, Interior made its decision before they had the FAA determination.
So why won't they need a supplemental EIS then, if there really is a concern about the environmental impact?
At a minimum, and I think the point here, though, is that FAA is making the kind of decisions that it knows going into the process would require environmental review, and they have an independent obligation to participate in that process to ensure.
Interior has some environmental expertise. Why add to it the FAA? The issues that are going to be caused here are ones that the Department of Interior, with help from the FAA, could do in one big EIS. Why one supplemental? What's the point of having the FAA do a separate one?
Because it's very basic, Your Honor. I understand what you're saying. And it can all be done in one EA or environmental impact statement or whatever is appropriate under NEPA. But FAA's decisions are independent major federal actions that are imposing obligations on parties as a condition of getting a government decision. And they should be required to comply with NEPA in whatever the appropriate manner is in connection with making their decision. And so that it's coordinated so that Interior doesn't make its decision before it has all the information about the project in hand. And FAA isn't making its decision in an environmental vacuum, which is the fundamental point of NEPA.
Imagine that the FAA discovered as a result of this that there was an environmental problem. Could it make a hazard determination based on an environmental problem? I mean, the intervener's argument is it has no authority.
Well, it has discretion as to what mitigation it would require and what the conditions it would impose on the no hazard determination.
So is the only issue, the environmental issue, only the mitigation issue?
In the immediate sense, but then under NEPA, I mean, they obviously would have to look at the consequences of their action if it's enabling, and that's where the cooperation with other agencies would help to cover the full analysis.
So, but the mitigation was just to install another radar, right?
Install radar, install lights. But of course, my point is, you don't know what the mitigation is going to be going in. What if they were requiring certain turbines to be lower? What if they were going to require them in a different location? Those would have clearly significant environmental.
But they didn't. We know what they've done. So those things they don't think are required for safety purposes. Would they have the authority to require the turbines to be lower for an environmental reason? Does the FAA have that authority?
Yes, I think they have discretion.
What's under what statute gives them discretion?
Well, this goes back to another point, is that there is, since their hazard determination is not specified in the statute, they're claiming essentially unlimited discretion as to what constitutes a hazard or not.
But it's a fair point, but it's all related to the purpose of this agency in this section, which is about safety. It's not about the environment. Is there some provision in this statute or in some other statute that requires them to, that could require them to not give a hazard, no hazard determination?
I don't have a citation off the top of my head, but I feel comfortable saying that in the general authorizing statutes, FAA is authorized to take into account environmental impacts, and they certainly do in any number of other kinds of decisions.
In the bird cases, bird strike cases,
right?
Who is making that environment? Who is requiring that NEPA? Is it the FAA or is it the Department of Interior or somebody else?
I don't know the answer, Your Honor.
Do you have anything?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take the matter under submission.